Career Jam is just around the corner on April 4th, and we are gearing up for one of the most exciting events of the year at Berkeley. It's an amazing opportunity for students to connect with prominent artists and industry leaders. Events like Career Jam are made possible by the support of our donors. If you want to help provide these opportunities to Berkeley students, visit berkeley.edu/giving.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Berkeley Alumni's Pass the Mic, where we pass the mic to you. My name is Jaquel.
I'm Patrick.
Hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. We were recording in the Red Room earlier.
Yes, we was.
For something that everybody will see next month. And just living the dream.
Living the dream.
We're together in the same space again today.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to be in the same space, as I'm sure everyone can imagine. Lots of laughs and good times.
It helps with the editing too.
Yes. But you guys couldn't tell anyway. We are in March. I know last month we talked about how fast these months are passing by, but it's like, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like nothing is going on, and then with one blink of an eye, everything is going on.
Mm-hmm. So the spring semester in particular is just a blur. So much going on.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden it's commencement, and then all of a sudden the school year's over.
Literally. What are some things that we're celebrating in March, boss?
Is this another quiz? It's Women's History Month. I know that.
Yes, it is Women's History Month. Shout out to all the women out there. I have been putting on campaigns for Women's History Month for about 3 years now, and the theme of them have changed. And this year's theme kind of just shines light on the evolution of kind of like seasoned women alumni in their fields and how they evolve. Like, how did their dreams and goals originate? And then how did that change? Like, the process of just the evolution of that and pivoting when things are going different. So I have been highlighting some women alums. So make sure you go check that out on our Instagram and our Facebook. I'm super thankful for the suggestions from my peers and also for the participation from the alums.
Yeah, it's great to see when the alumni are like excited to participate in these things.
Yes.
Sometimes, I'm not going to lie, it's like pulling teeth. Other times, yes. Stuff like this, people just organically come out and it's great. It's tough to do themed months because sometimes the perception is like, why are you only highlighting women in March for Women's History Month?
That's
but I mean, the fact is we have to ensure that we're representing everybody throughout the year, but also we can't not do certain things in certain months either.
Right.
So it's really a push and pull in making sure that if we are using certain people or topics for certain months, that we're making people aware of it so they don't feel like they're being used or, you know, just exactly. Kind of like checking a box. So
absolutely. And I also think like we are storytellers and we are telling the stories of alums, whether it's through our social media, whether it's through this Pass the Mic podcast, you know. And I just feel like it's super important to have these conversations. And then you never know. Everyone, we all go through similar things, no matter how different they may be. There's always some type of similarities. Just being able to share voices so that people can learn from and also be like, hey, I see myself in that person's story. I think that is meaningful. And so we tell people's story no matter who they are and where they are in life. And I think that it is important to showcase that in the work that we do.
Absolutely. And this interview is really a great compliment to the campaign that you're doing.
I agree.
Because Natalie Toro has so many stories and has such wisdom in her experiences. Mm-hmm. And she's a conservatory alumna.
Yes. Love when we can switch it up and bring some BoCo alumni into the mix. So, boss, tell us a little bit about Natalie.
Natalie is a Broadway theater actress. She has an insane resume and also is the first in a lot of her roles. So she was the first American to play Eponine in Les Mis. And she was the first Latina woman to play Eva Perón in Evita. She also played Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff. You're going to hear it, so I won't repeat it.
Right.
But she's also done a lot of TV work in New York, and just really is not only just an amazing person, an amazingly talented person, but just the sheer success that she's had is amazing. And I always love when we meet people that have just really just shot through the roof, and they're just nice.
Yes, super nice, great personality. We was able to interview her last year when she received the Alumni Achievement Award. And so just the knowledge and experience that she shared with us is definitely meaningful. And I'm excited for you all to hear. So here is the episode.
I haven't been here in years, and Boston, just Boston itself, has changed so much. Mm. It's become just so, you know, clean and energetic. And, you know, I think that when I went to school, it felt like it was just starting to figure out what it was as a city. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially the location of the college, which was Boston Conservatory, in that little nook, it kind of felt like, yeah, you know, I don't want to go anywhere at night, you know, by yourself, you know. But I mean, I'm from the Bronx, so I was kind of used to that city survival thing. But just coming here, I got in late last night, and it was, of course, pouring, and I couldn't really see out the windshield. But Just going down the street of Exeter, and then Boylston. Going, Boylston was always kind of trying to be hip with the restaurants and everything, but now I would like to stay here for a week.
It's a lot going on this street for sure, absolutely. And how was the tour earlier?
Oh my goodness! First of all, the fact that the two schools have merged really is exciting. The amount of information the students have now, I'm a little bit jealous because it is, I mean, so much. They're prepared more for real life than when I was in school.
They get everything earlier.
We just toured the Berkeley section, and just going to the recording studios alone and them being able to be a guest conductors for the Boston Symphony, and I'm like, what?
All these opportunities,
right? Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited for the future alum, because they're going to be they have such a plethora of information to go out there as soon as they take that first step.
Yeah,
they're going to have so much information.
I think that's part of it too, is that Boston, it has embraced the arts a little more and has kind of taken these institutional artistic organizations and weaved them into kind of the culture of the city.
Absolutely. And that's what I was trying to say. Like, it was always a college town, but the arts kind of got lost when I was here. So now it's huge. How many buildings to this school now? I mean, you got to walk a lot now.
Right. Absolutely. Especially.
It's like a little city.
Yeah, we feel for the students that have to walk during the crazy weather out here in Boston.
Yeah, I remember that bone chilling wind.
Yes.
On Boylston Street.
Yes. Yeah. But you were used to it because you were from New York, so.
I'm used to it. Yeah, but Boston still had its special cold. Yeah.
Yes, it can be bitter and brick out here. So I want to start off today's interview with talking about how you had your first solo performance for Amateur Night at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. Yes. Like, how was that? Because were you nervous of being womped off the stage? Or like, whose idea was that? Was that something that you want to do?
Well, first of all, I was 5.
Right.
And when you're 5 years old, you don't have a care in the world. And all I know is it's true. Supposed to just memorize the lyrics, practice with the band that my father and mother have hired. I had a 5-piece band.
Wow.
And all I know is I had to just memorize those lyrics. And I was practicing and practicing. And the memory is so clear because it was all about the preparation. You know, I come from a Latin family. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of information about performance. But for some reason, my father got a whiff of the Apollo and Amateur Night. And I was always singing with him. You know, he was teaching me songs. He played the guitar. And he's a beautiful singer as well. And I, you know, he goes, hey, how would you like to perform? And I was like, okay. what I have to do. So, and then what happened was the memory I have is not just rehearsing it in the living room constantly over and over. I sang a song, "Which way you going, Billy? Can I go too? Please don't forget me, Billy." It's a, you're 5 years old and you're talking about a boy. And, you know, and, but what was really, what's really profound in my brain is that the performance date, the day of the performance, the audience is crazy, right? They're like, ah! You know, and I was wearing my little Mary Janes and patent leather little Mary Janes, and my mom made my hair really curly for the show. And I remember once they introduced me, all I could hear were my Mary Janes hitting the wooden floor, the stage.
Wow. Everything was silent.
It was, yeah, it was the weirdest thing, because then the audience was like looking at me, this little 5 year old's coming out like, huh?
Yeah.
So they quieted down for a little bit. And then the funniest thing about this whole thing is that I had rehearsed with the band, obviously, and they had the mic on a stand. And in the microphone during that performance, I had said, "I want to hold the mic." And the band leader, he's trying to get the mic stand down to my level. He's like, and I said, "I want to hold the mic." And he is just, you know, said, he's trying to whisper, "Natalie, this is how we, you know, we rehearsed it. So we have to leave the microphone on the stand. I want to hold the mic." And by that time, the audience is like, "Let her hold the mic." They were screaming into each other. So he had no choice.
Yes.
So he took the mic stand away and gave me the mic. And I whipped that wire. Like, I just knew what I was doing. And I sang the song. I don't remember. I don't think it was like a winning situation back then, where somebody won amateur night. It was just amateur night type of thing. But that really catapulted me to what I do now.
Wow. Right? Yeah, obviously it was a decent experience. It stuck.
It was amazing. Yeah.
I also like that, like when you're like, "I want the mic," when you're fighting for it, you start to get the audience on your side anyways.
Yes. It didn't matter. He had no choice. No choice.
That is amazing and really impressive. Did you know, like, before then that this was kind of the career that you wanted to go into?
No.
Or it was just like, okay, this is what I'm made for.
No. But after that performance, I didn't leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And then I just was singing in the house all day long. You know, I was very dramatic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we'd watch TV. And if something really, really affected me, I'd be like, "Oh, Dad, I'm just melting like butter." You know, and he was like, "Oh, my Lord." You know, so it was a lot of drama coming from Natalie.
So then how did you wind up at the conservatory?
Ooh, that's a story.
Yeah, I bet.
So the kids nowadays, when they audition, it is rough. Like, I can't, they got like 16 bars. They got to film themselves now. I mean, it is rough, right? Back in the day, I was going to the High School of Music and Art, and I wanted to go to an Ivy League school. I don't know. I think I wanted to prove something to my family, you know, but I don't know how I was going to get in with an SAT score of like 200, you know, so there was no way I was going to do that. But so I kind of didn't really know where I wanted to go. So the conservatory came to the High School of Music and Art, which is where I was attending.
Okay.
And they had auditions.
Yeah.
And so
on the spot?
On the spot. No, they, like, literally I found out that day. That day,
they used to do that. Yeah.
Sign up if you want to audition for the Boston Conservatory of Music, Theater and Dance. That's what it was called.
Wow.
And I was like, "Wait, what? Music?" You know, cuz at that time I didn't really know I wanted to act. I thought I just want to sing.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I'll get in for singing or something, right? So I signed up. I had an appointment. I walked in and I sang Moon River.
Wow.
And I got in.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I got in. Funny. That's all I had to do.
That's crazy.
That's all I had to do. No acting. No, I had no acting experience. No, nothing. So I got in. So all I know is remembering my freshman year acting. Like, ooh, what's that?
How was the process of learning about acting since it was a new kind of language?
Well, like I said, I'm from the Bronx, and it was always, I was tough, you know, I was a tough little, like, well, What do you mean I gotta walk in the room, look at the pencil, pick up the pencil, put the pencil down and walk down? I said, what is that?
Right.
You know, like I didn't understand the concept of acting at all, but that was our first exercise freshman year. And so all my freshman friends, we just met. It was September, you know, we just met and that was the first exercise. And I became a comedian because I was like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I don't understand why I got to go in and look at why.
Right.
So, but by asking why and why and why is how I learned why.
Well, it's that thing too of like when you grow up and you gotta have to be tough and you have to put on like that tough suit. When you get into things like that where it's performative, it feels wrong. And so,
well, you have to open up, you have to be vulnerable.
Exactly.
And I was like, I ain't vulnerable. I'm not going to show you what I got. No. So it was very, freshman year was a fight. Really? It was a fight for me, my professors. They were like, oh, here she comes.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't difficult. I was just always questioning because I didn't understand why we had to do all that stuff.
There's nothing wrong with that.
You know, because I'm very instinctual. You know, it's like if you want me to, you know, but just tell me why. And I had a professor, Fran Charnas, who I think is still at the school. And, you know, I learned a lot. I learned a lot from her. And because it was the same thing. It was kind of like, what's your truth?
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I never changed who I was. I thought, you know, when you get into your first Broadway contract, and I was just me. I didn't
That's
have,
good.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you stuck around Boston for a while after you graduated. What made you stay here?
I didn't want to.
What did you say earlier? It was about 89?
86. I graduated. Lord.
I tried to throw you a couple of years now.
I know. But 86, I graduated and I felt like I needed to stay in town. I decided to do the singing waitress thing out in on the Cape for the summer. I thought that would be a fun thing to do. You know, you graduate and you're just like, let's have fun and make some money, you know. And then I decided I didn't want to go to New York without my union card. And nowadays, I think young artists have a lot more opportunity to join the union. Whereas back in my day, you couldn't join the union unless you were in a show that gave you the card. So I didn't want to go back to New York without that. And so I thought, let's stay in town. I got an apartment with another alumni. And we were like, okay, let's just see what happens. And a show came in called A My Name is Alice from New York.
Okay.
And I thought this would be a great opportunity for me to, how could I, maybe I could get in somehow. I didn't know anything really, right? So I spoke to the stage manager and I was like, how should I audition? Well, they're coming from New York, so they already have, but they're looking for understudies.
Okay.
So I got to understudy the younger, I think there were four women in the show, and I got to understudy the two younger characters. But the caveat is that I had to be an assistant stage manager. And if you know Natalie Toro, Natalie does not like the backstage. I hated it. I hated shopping for props. I hated handing the actresses the props. I was like, no. You know, I, a little diva, you know, and I needed to be in front of the stage. And, but that gave me such, like what the students are having now, where they get to be in shows and do things like that. Right. That was my hands-on. And that was after school, you know. And I knew I hated that, so I wasn't going to go that route, you know. But I got my card. And that's what was important. And then since then, I did a show called Shebopin', which Fran Charnas conceived and directed. And that was at the Wilbur Theater, when the Wilbur Theater actually converted itself to a cabaret-style room, which was interesting. So so I did that show, and the show got really good reviews, I believe. I don't remember the reviews, but I think we did. And right after Shebopin', I moved to New York, and I'm like, I have my card. I got some shows under my belt now. I'm ready to go. And I was in New York about 2 weeks when I auditioned for the Japan tour of West Side Story.
Wow.
And I got in, and so we toured Japan for 7 weeks. And while I was in Japan, they were auditioning for the national tour of Les Miserables, and I was crying. Because I was all the way around the world, like the other side of the world, and I could not come in. I was like, I have to play that role. I have to play that role. I have to get into that show. So I was really bummed out about that. However, as it turns out, when I got back from Japan, now, I don't know if y'all been to Japan, but when you get back, the jet lag is intense.
You're not a happy camper.
No, you're not.
Neither is your stomach.
No, I mean, you are when everyone else is awake, you're sleeping. Mm-hmm. Like, it really takes about a good week or two to get back. And so when I was back, they were having private auditions. The casting director was Vinnie Liff at that time. And I don't know how, I think from West Side, I got on some private list. Back then, things were all paper and no computer stuff. It was just all who you know, what you know, you know. And I went in for Vinnie Liff for a Vienna company of cats. And he put me on some sort of list because I started to sing Memory. And he was like, no, I don't want to sing that song. I don't want you to sing that song. Sing something else. So I sang On My Own from Les Mis. Not really connecting that he was the casting director for Les Mis too, right?
Wow.
You don't think that. You know, you're so young, your energy's all over the place. And so it turned out that I was on some sort of list to be called whenever there was an Eponine opening. And so I literally was still jet lagging from Japan. And they called and they said, hey, so we're having private auditions for the role of Eponine for New York. And even that didn't sink in. Because I thought it was a tour, you know.
Right.
In New York for the tour. And he was like, no, Nat, for Broadway. I was like, oh, I didn't have an agent. Like,
wow.
It was just,
wow.
Yeah, it was all like talk, who do you know, what's happening. And so then I went in for that private, it was a Saturday audition. And I walked in and there were 10 other women there that looked just like Eponine. And I was like, what am I doing here? What am I doing here? Right? And yeah, so then the rest is history. I booked it and I did it for 3.5 years.
When you came on to Les Mis, were people like, who is this girl? She came out of Boston and then she was doing a tour. Like, because most of those people were grinding it out in New York for years, right?
Well, yes. And the show had only really been barely a year old on Broadway. So there was still a lot of buzz around it. Now I think buzz kind of dies really quick. But back then, you know, if a new character went in, then the media comes in. And I replaced Frances Raphael. So I was the first American to play, because she's from London, you know, to play the role. She went back to London. And so it was very, it was one of those things, like I said, I stayed with my truth and who I was and, you know, and who I am. And I kind of went in there with an amazing work ethic. And I think that's what the conservatory taught me, was you need to treat people really nice. You need to know where your mark is. You need to know your information. You need to know your music. And I did. I learned the show in like 14 days. And I was on.
That's nuts.
Yeah. And I can't even tell you what that feeling was like, because like, it's hard to express it into words when you're opening on Broadway, you know, at the biggest Broadway theater, which is the Broadway Theater on 53rd. And but again, something magical happened right before my audition, which for your spiritual people out there, right? So right before my audition, I had my book in my hands and I walked by the theater.
Wow.
And all the pictures of the characters are on the marquee and things. So I'm looking at the Eponine, and it kind of like in a movie, you know how it just like a wave happens. And, and then I actually saw myself in that photo.
Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know if it was like the law of attraction or I just manifested it. I don't know. Yes. But it was such a beautiful moment for me to feel really confident to walk in and just do my best.
And like own it. Like I got this.
And yeah. And even if nothing happened, I really wanted it more than anything. So during the audition, I started coughing really badly. It was June. It was hot, humid. And back in the 80s, you know, the dress code wasn't so great. I mean, literally. I mean, you think about the fashion from the 80s, right? So I walked into this audition. And again, this is something that I'm so glad that students now are getting all that information. Like, you walk into audition, you walk in dressed your best, like comfortable, but yet you're presenting your whole package, right? I walked in with these parachute white balloony pants, right? With a pink checkered button down oversized shirt. Cause I thought I want to dress like an urchin, like a street person, right? So that was my version of it. That was not good. That was not good. But I am, so I don't know if it was nerves or so in the middle of the, of me singing on my own, I started coughing, but like coughing, like it's hard to come back from that kind of coughing.
Right, yeah.
And there was this huge bottle of Evian water. It like the table was filled because this is like a major replacement, right, for their show. So the table was filled with casting, producers, everybody. And there was this very large bottle of Evian water in the middle of the table. I didn't know whose it was and I didn't care. And so I kind of said, hey, can I have a sip? And they were like, sure. Meanwhile, I'm like bleeding. My ears are bleeding from coughing, you know? And I could barely talk. I was like this. And so I chugged half that bottle. And they said, okay, Natalie, do you want to start where you left off? Okay. Trying to get back my voice. And I did. I got through. And I think they liked what they saw. And I did not know that Cameron McIntosh was in the other room. So they were only calling him in for someone that they thought was worth his viewing.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he came in and I got to sing it again.
Oh, cool.
And redeem myself this time.
Yes.
Well, I mean, you know, you grab the water, the show has to keep going. I'm, you know, like, you do whatever you have.
It's your fault you had water there.
Yeah.
The reason why that water was there.
Well, so then from there, I have your a little bit of your resume up. You were Grisabella in Cats.
Yes.
You were Ava Perone in Evita. You also were in A Christmas Carol. You were Mary Magdalene in Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yes, sir.
Those are, you know, I would say,
roles.
Yeah.
Humongous.
Those aren't bit parts.
Yeah.
How do you, my interest is that first role and how you navigate that.
Eponine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you're gaining more experience, do you see the difference between when you look back and you're like, oh, that was me when I first started?
Yes. Because I did Les Mis for 3.5 years, I felt like I got better.
Sure.
In the role. I also used a lot of what Fran Charnas taught me. And I tell her whenever I get a chance to tell her, I'm like, you know, you're the reason I'm here. Really.
Wow. Because I can totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I really took everything that she said as incredible knowledge, and I just spun it for me, right? So yeah, I sounded really young, and now I'm all alone again. And there is like some sort of recording going around from 1990. It's very funny. I hear, I'm like, whoa, wow, you know. So then, as every year went by, obviously there's new cast members going in and new things happening, the world things are happening, whatever. But I knew that every time I hit that stage, my work ethic kicked in. And it was more about that audience is seeing it for the first time. And so I have to give it. I have to serve for the first time, no matter how I feel. I could feel like, ugh, crap. I could feel like I've performed a lot with bronchitis or the flu because my two understudies were out. Uh-huh. Or, you know, because in a big company like that, it's like 35 company members. one person gets sick, it's going to go around, you know? And so then next thing you know, there are no swings. So, you know, so that the show must go on. I would go on if I had a bloody stump of a leg, you know, it just didn't matter. So the work ethic never changed. What changed was just my own personal growth as a person. And so these roles, so now my next role after that was a cat, you know, and I did Cats twice. So the first time I did it, it was my first tour. I hated touring. I thought this was so lame. I was like, I know you get to see the country, blah, 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 and get paid for it. Great. Love it. But no, I didn't like touring. I didn't like, I think it was just maybe the energy of that show too. It was, okay. just, you know, like those cats were really catty. Yeah. as a company, you know, so and I come in like fresh faced, and I believe I was the youngest Grisabella ever hired at that time.
Wow.
So to have an experience of, so now I'm thinking, how do I look at this role when I haven't had the experience as Grisabella? Right. So then I start looking at people in my family, like people I look up to, like what were their experiences? What were and I made it my own. And let me tell you, that audience was waiting for that song.
Yeah.
That was it. And it had to be right on every time. It didn't matter how I felt, didn't matter what was happening, didn't matter if my tail got caught in my heels, you know, I would get up from the floor and sing that big note, and you know, and that, I knew that that was important. And then after that, I did a lot of, whenever I did go to do regional theater, I did mostly new works, which was great. And that to me helped me be more creative than just coming in and replacing someone.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So like I did, you know, Henry Krieger's Everything's Ducky. I was the lead. I was the duck. The duck.
Animals.
You know? Yeah. I did Marcus Hammond's, you know, Frances and Guernica. I did Dana Rose, The Fix. I did all those incredible shows that now have a life.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I did Fame, the first rendition of Fame, the world, a lot of world premieres.
Yeah. Wow.
And that to me, I think really shaped me as an artist because I was able to create something from the bottom up. I never liked replacing anyone.
Yeah.
You know, well,
and then you, so you're the first American in this role, and then you're the first Latina person in this role, and then you're the first, you're the youngest person in this role.
Yeah.
There's always something that you're working, maybe not against, but with.
With. And I think that that really just helped me grow as a person and also having that responsibility. And it was mostly the leads or the co-star. So you had that, like, now, for instance, doing Eva Perón, that's been done forever, right? But I was the first Latina to play Eva Perón.
Right.
I mean, hello, right? So, so that also took on a whole other sort of energy and life because I'm Latina.
Right.
You know, I was able to bring, you know, and Raul Esparza was my Che, you know, and so we both on stage, there was so much passion and so much energy. When there was anger, forget it. The audience would be like, whoa, I need a drink after this, you know, because it was just, it's never been done like that.
Yeah.
You know, and this was the show that was supposed to come in to New York because it was the 20th anniversary tour coming to New York. And then Andrew Lloyd Webber pulled it and brought in Superstar instead. I was like, whatever. Thank you.
So Patrick talked about all of the different roles you played in theater, but you've also played many roles for television.
Yes.
Like Law and Order. And so I wanted to know if you had like a preference. Do you rather do television or theater? Like, do you have a favorite?
I will give you an experience, my very first television experience, because back in the day, and I hate saying that. I can't believe I'm actually saying that now, right? Back in the day, casting directors didn't like to give TV and film to theater people.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Okay. Because I never learned how to act on camera. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a whole other skill. Mm. So this casting director for Law and Order, the very first one with Jerry Orbach.
Yeah.
And Chris Noth, right? Mm. So, and you know, I auditioned. I went into the office, I auditioned, and she really liked it. And she goes, try it this way. And I auditioned. She was like, wow, so you've never done television before? I'm like, no, you know. She's like, well, you know what? Okay, all right. I'm going to give you a break. I'm going to have you come in. I really like the way you read. So I was really excited. I had an agent at that time, you know. And so I'm on set. You want to talk about green? I didn't know anything. I didn't know what was what, you know. Wow. I didn't even know that this girl who was playing an extra became friends with me while I was standing there ready, because she said, you have, you know, she thought I had lines. Yeah. She's going to be in the shot with me because I have lines. And don't you know, that's what the director did. Wow. He put her in the shot. You know, I was like, oh, wow. All about Eve, right? So, and Chris Noth actually helped me, because he must have known, because I did, I tried to do the scene differently every time.
Yeah.
And they were like, cut!
Make it harder for the cut. Edit process.
Yes. Oh, yes. My God. I didn't know.
Yeah. Don't you know we have to get home?
And we were outside on Central Park. No, Riverside Park. And the director just came in. She's like, Natalie, smaller. Just a little smaller. Like you did in the room. Smaller. I was like, oh, okay. Next thing I know, I'm doing my thing. And I was playing an accent, a Latin person, you know, with a thick accent. And I was just like, I gotta show my rings in this one. You know. So anyway, and Chris was like, okay, so you have to really keep it the same every time we do it. I was like, what? Yes. And then he said, you see that X on the ground? I had no idea what that X meant. He goes, you see that X on the ground? He goes, you got to stop, stand there right as you say your line.
Wow.
I was like, oh, that's what that's for. Yeah, that's where you have to stand. So he was so nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was so grateful for him. And I said, thank you so much. And so anyway, so whenever I watch that little clip, because it's in my reel, you know,
yes.
I'm just like, oh, my God.
The memories and flashbacks. Just
just green. Just like, right. You know, then, you know, once you get one thing on your resume, then casting directors take you a little bit more serious.
Mm. Sure.
You know, so then I got another Law and Order and then an SVU. Mariska Hargitay actually called me Two Take Toro, which was really fun. Yeah. She was like, man, two takes. Awesome. Two Take Toro. I like you. So you asked if I prefer it. I love it. It's different. Mm. The only thing is the hours. You're waiting a long time for them to get to you. Mm. You know, when I did Person of Interest, I was playing a casino cashier. And by the time they went through the casino and did all the little shots before they got to me, I had literally been on set for 17 hours.
Wow.
And I was so tired. My makeup's like caking and, you know, and I'm standing there
and I'm like,
oh, what is my line? Oh, my God. Like, what are my lines now? Because I'm so tired and punchy. And finally, the director's like, so sorry. We're finally getting to you. And so I did my lines. And so it's different. It's fun. It's completely, you meet someone and you got to make out with them right away. Because, you know, that's the weirdest thing.
Yeah.
The weirdest thing. You meet someone. I did a film and I was like, oh, hi. Okay, there you go. And go make out with them. So it's weird, you know. You're like, please don't eat the everything bagel.
Right. No, yeah, absolutely.
Please don't have onions, because that really is going
to
suck, right?
That's what they said Luke Perry used to do to Shannon Doherty on 90210.
Oh,
he used to like eat like the everything potato chips right before like a big makeout scene.
Terrible. I love the residuals.
Mm.
You don't realize that until you have 5 cents in your bank account.
There you go.
Next thing you know, a SAG checks come from something. Yeah. My very first SAG thing was doing Walla, which I don't know if you guys know what that is. That's when they're shooting a scene, they're shooting the two people, like if they're in a restaurant, and they're not shooting the background noise. The background noise gets added in post.
Yeah.
So I learned Walla the first time out. out, and that's how I got my SAG card. A friend of mine owned a company that got hired by the Hollywood studios to do the wall on the background. And so my my very first Walla experience was for Hellraiser 3.
Oh, my God.
The guy with the pinheads, yeah. Right? And if you know me, I do not like horror flicks. And all I had to do was watch this horror flick on this huge screen with a microphone and do all the background, like when someone's getting murdered or like...
Oh my God.
Like all that stuff in post. It was very funny. Or like a nurse running, you know, from the killer. And she's like, like it was very fun. That was fun to do. And I still get residual checks. Granted, they're like 5 cents.
Right, yeah.
But it's a check.
Yeah. Hey, we love money.
That must be such a culture shock, too, where, you know, you're on stage and then everything has to happen at once and you have people helping you backstage, like, you know, like you're really the center of attention. And then you get into these film sets and it's you're kind of part of an ensemble and you're.
Yes. But on film, I will say when they call you the talent, they do treat you like the talent. I mean, they show you your little Winnebago trailer on the street, you know, however, they expect you to know your stuff.
Sure.
You know, so when I did like Elementary, that was shot in on a hotel, a really nice hotel in the city, in the basement, you know.
Sheesh.
So that, you know, that's a night shoot, you know. So you just have to know where to go or just actually stay and wait to be told where to go.
Yeah.
Mm. Whereas, and also, you know, the camera, the camera's right there. It's right there. You move an eyelash, it's huge, right? So I really had to learn how to, from my very first Law and Order, I've had to learn to just calm it down and be more like a conversation. Like, this is what we're doing right here. Not like in theater, you have to reach the back row.
Yeah.
Mm. Totally different.
I remember a directing class in film school and they were talking about John Wayne and his thing was, you know, if you're on stage, you want to say, they went that away. But if it's on film, you want them to just say, they went that way.
They went that way.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And my last thing I did recently was the shoot West Side Story with Steven Spielberg.
Right, yeah.
And that was truly amazing because I think 40,000 people auditioned for that film.
Wow.
I mean, everybody wanted to be in that film.
Yeah.
And he was doing it very authentic. Like, you know, he really wanted real Spanish people, you know, and whatever else, you know, was happening, he really wanted to be true to the, you know, the nationality and stuff. And you know, till this day, they still can't ask you, what's your heritage?
Yeah.
You know, however, they did because he wanted real authentic, you know, the culture to come out, you know? So that's a funny shoot story because now I know what it is. I've done it. But now it's Steven Spielberg. Now it's a whole other level.
Sure.
Of genius. Right.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And I was really calm and I was like, okay, Steven Spielberg. Oh my God, here we go. You know, so there was a lot of like, you know, rehearsing for the song. I was in the American number rehearsing for the song, and then you go into the studio and then you record the song because I don't know if people know that you actually have to record everything before they shoot it. Mm-hmm. Then they put these little teeny eeny pieces of this in your ear. It looks like the size of like a I don't know. Less than a Tic Tac,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And it goes in your ear. And so that's the track playing. Oh, wow. So while they're shooting, you sing to your track.
Sure.
You know, and you really sing. So it
out loud.
Yeah.
You know,
your muscles,
but you have to hear the track, you know? And so one of my thing was hanging out the window. I don't know how much time we have here because I have lots of stories, but my thing was hanging out the window to say my line. And of course, I tell you the shoots are very long. So I'm literally hanging out the window on one butt cheek halfway out for hours.
Right.
And it's the hottest day in New York City. It was a heat wave where it's like 100 degrees. And, you know, and you're in costume and the makeup. They keep
sweating,
patting you, you know, down.
Hair.
And hair and all that stuff. And And the windowsill, because it was an old tenement building in Washington Heights, and so the windowsill was crumbling as I was, you know, I'm leaning, and that's the only thing I could lean on, and the sill was crumbling, and I was just, and I said, excuse me, Steven? Because I was up on the fifth floor and he's down in the courtyard. Yeah, Natalie. So we might have a problem here because this windowsill is crumbling and I might fall to my death.
Right.
If that's the shot you want. Right. You know, he was like, oh my gosh, we can't have that. So they stopped, you know, for a minute and they sent a stagehand up to the apartment I was in, and he rigged me up like a harness underneath my dress. Harnessed me up and he with a chain, with a rope, and he was on the floor holding me in.
Oh my God.
He said, you're not gonna fall now. Not on his watch.
Isn't that fun?
When you don't want to hold up the set either, and then you're like, I have to tell this to Steven Spielberg or I might die.
Oh, I might die. Right in front of him, and they'll just replace me.
Yep.
Well, we don't have too much time left, but we're going to have you back at some point.
Oh my God, absolutely. Yay! Absolutely. Please.
But we haven't talked about, so you did a one-woman show and you're doing coaching now as well?
Yes. So, you know, pandemic hit, and as with a lot of people during the pandemic, you start reevaluating your life and what's happening and stuff. And I felt this calling to serve. And I was like, I didn't know how it was going to be. However, I thought, you know what? Just teach what you know. I have credibility. Mm-hmm. I have over 35 years of experience. And why not?
Right.
Why not give it to people, you know, to students or aspiring, you know, performers that I didn't have that, you know, so why not? So I started teaching voice and acting on Zoom, and I didn't know how that was going to go because you're not there, you know, in person. So I just kind of, I didn't even put the word out, you know, I was just like, oh yeah. And then all of a sudden people, are you coaching? I heard you're coaching. So then it started happening, and then I'm like, wow, I'm really good. Also because I've had such great training and also on the field, you know, and I felt like, so I've not only teaching the coaching voice and music and auditioning and stuff, I feel like I'm becoming a life coach when someone asks me, what happens if this happens? Like, what would I do? What should I do?
Sure.
Or, oh my God, I feel so less than today. I feel so, you know, and we have a therapy session. We don't have a lesson, but I end up coaching that way. And so what I did this whole last year is I started an online course, and it's called Break a Leg.
Okay. Congrats.
Break a Leg. And thank you. And it's a hard thing to do, to develop, when you don't really know a lot about the internet and a lot about how online things work. You know, when you're a baby boomer like me, you're just like, ooh, okay. So marketing online, what, you know?
Yeah.
So, but I felt like this was something I wanted to do. At the same time, I am also a personal coach, and it is so rewarding. I just had a lesson yesterday before I got on the road to come here, and my student crossed that threshold yesterday, and we were both crying. Aww. And this was just her fourth lesson.
Wow.
So I was like, okay, I have something really important to give and to share.
Yeah.
And people are getting it.
And you get something out of it too. You're not doing it because
I'm crying with them, and I want them to succeed because their success is my success, you know?
Right.
And I've really, really gotten on this bandwagon of coaching. I was like, I'm still auditioning. I'm still doing my thing and getting back into the world. But this thing to me is like, I could do this from home.
Right. Yeah.
No, in my pajamas. Right. You know, on Zoom, I just have to wear a nice top.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
But I also started a little show called She Shed Talk.
Oh.
And I own a She Shed.
There you go.
Yes.
Nice.
And it's beautiful. And you know, part of the launch of the course, I started going online every day. Like, it's called, you know, Music Mondays, where I sing a little something. Mm-hmm. And people love it because people are like, ooh, what's she going to sing today? You know,
yeah.
A little 30 seconds of something. And then Tuesdays, it's called Tuesdays Tips with Toro.
Nice.
So I give like a tip, anything, audition tip, or last time was do not say you're sorry at an audition.
Sure.
You know, so I just give little little tips for hungry people, you know.
Some gems.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Wednesday is called Why Wednesday. And I just talk about something like why? Why are theater people so sweet and they become family immediately? Like that type of stuff. And
yeah.
Theatrical Thursday and then Fun Friday. And so it what that has done is really made me like sit there and learn how to edit and work it out. And I just release it every day. And so what I did last week is I talked and I said Thursday She Shed Talk's going to be amazing. You know, I didn't tell anybody about it, but this is going to be great She Shed Talk, and eventually do a podcast.
Nice.
So this is awesome, you know, and my course is called, it's www.natalietorocoaching.com. That's where you find the course.
Awesome.
Nice. And yeah, and emails and, you know,
excellent.
Just starting to
absolutely
get this out there.
And we're back. That was our episode with Natalie Toro. Any, you know, closing thoughts? What'd you think?
We've been doing a lot of these now, and the theme that I'm seeing is it seems like it's just chance. Some of these things that happen, you know, you go to an audition and you have a coughing fit, you don't expect to get the role, but then all of a sudden you're the first American to play Eponine in Les Mis, and you're on Broadway for 3.5 years. But a lot of the people that we've interviewed that have had success, I think about like Mark Kelly and, you know, thinking about moving back to Texas. And then all of a sudden he gets a call to be the bass player for the Roots. Matt Zalee being in high school and really like looking up to Pentatonix. And all of a sudden he replaces the bass singer there. There's something to be said about putting yourself in the moment to be able to receive that chance and that opportunity and that luck. Listening to this one, I was like, I see a theme here. It's luck, it's chance, but it's also being resilient enough to stay in the game so that when that moment arises, you're there and you're ready.
Yeah, I think resilient is definitely a great word to put. I agree. It always seems like through these stories, life is a full circle, and it's evident as things always come back around. And I think with Natalie, you know, she definitely just exemplifies and shows like what hard work and, like you said, just to keep going. And that is definitely an ongoing theme that we see within our alums, just to keep going and just put all the hard work and the dedication. And when your time is ready, when that time has come, then you will be ready.
Mm-hmm. And it's the same between college and conservatory alums. Mm-hmm. It's just this thing about just staying in the game long enough for your moment to come up.
Right. It's coming.
And as always, I can't stop talking about our Variation Signature Series, which you can find at youtube.com/Berkeley Alumni. And this month we have Sarah Tudson of Illuminati Hotties. And we're going to have her song that is featured in the video play us out today. So happy Women's History Month.
Happy
everybody.
Women's History Month. Thanks for listening, and tune in next month for the next episode.
Patience is a painful gift. What a shame to you aren't even any time soon. Sweat your off in bed unmade. Comment you fall. Boy, you're giving me an earful. All about the rotten fits of haze.
Spades. My mercy to the lies. Drive me one time.
stay all day. In the morning, wake up feeling was cool.